This is Officer Mikhail Pavlovitskyvich of the Lan Arcanum High Guard, found on the Lawful and Orderly podcast. And you are listening to the Redemption Podcast, a proud member of the RPG Academy Network.
This is Redemption, an actual play podcast set in the Star Wars role-playing game system.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Behind the Screen with your Game Master, Chris. This is Season 3's Behind the Screen. And before we get into it, I just want to take a few minutes and say thank you to everybody that made Season 3 the amazing season that it was. All the special guests, Danny Neary for bringing Verita to life, John Neary for bringing Ilar in, Richard Kreitz-Landry for bringing in Reese, Melissa Berlew, my wife, for playing Reese's wife. That sounds awkward, but you get the idea. And also, I cannot forget Angela and Billy from the Fandible podcast for bringing Adir and Keita to life. That was an amazing episode. And I will say, you guys have an amazing podcast, and everybody that's not listening to it, you should be, because they do a phenomenal job. Also, big thank you to Emily for bringing Isla to life. And thank you so much for joining the crew. This episode, I decided to continue with the concept of kind of pulling back the screen and showing everybody a little bit behind the scenes stuff. I asked Tanner, who is the game master for the Shadow of the Cabal podcast, the number one L5R actual play in the world. That's right, I said it, in the world. Tanner and I just got together and we talked about how we plan our games, some of the stuff that happens in our games, and use some examples from our shows. So without further ado, please enjoy. Season 3 is Behind the Screen. Well, welcome to a little bonus episode we're doing here. This is Chris, the Game Master for the Redemption, and with me, I have a special guest. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, I am Tanner from the Shadow of the Cabal podcast. I am the GM and showrunner of that show, also on the RPG Academy Network.
Tonight, we're going to continue with our trend of doing a little bonus episode. I asked Tanner to come on and just sit down and talk tonight. We both run long-run AP podcasts, and I thought it'd be neat to just kind of talk about how we prepare our games, how we run our games, and kind of compare and contrast the differences. I think it might be neat because I think you and I might have a little different style.
Yeah, I think just to pull the curtain back a little bit here, I think everyone on our shows pretty much talk to one another casually every once in a while. And we have teased out that you and I run games very differently, but I think we arrive at a product that is not too dissimilar, I would say.
Oh, absolutely. I would agree. And because we're just having a discussion, we're going to keep it pretty casual. I'm going to keep it casual when we do the editing too. Try to give everybody the feel as if you're sitting at the table with Tanner and I, just kind of listening in to our rambling, so to speak. All right. So, well, let's just jump right into it. Let's talk about how we prepare a session. How in-depth is your planning?
It varies from session to session, obviously, but I kind of like to start planning big picture. I'm definitely sort of an outside-in kind of guy. That ranges to, you know, when I started my campaign, Shadow of the Cabal. Oh, I guess I should mention, we're probably going to spoil some episodes of our shows here to one another. So I'm going to probably be talking about specific moments. I'm not going to blow any huge twists out of the water or anything, but just be warned, if you have interest in Shadow of the Cabal, I'm going to be talking about some events that happen, and I'm sure Chris is going to be talking about some specific moments from Redemption as well.
Absolutely.
When I started Shadow of the Cabal, I knew that it was going to be a mystery, and so I made the entire framework of the campaign scale mystery first. And so in that regards, my prep and my planning was sort of front loaded. I spent a lot of time, a couple weeks, kind of putting that together, and then once I had the big skeleton of the conspiracy, I connected each little bit of it together and figured that each element of it would probably be its own adventure or its own session. So from the start, this is a big difference between your show and my show, which is I knew that the campaign was finite and I knew kind of where the ending was going to end up. But from what I understand, big picture speaking, as far as planning wise, what does that look like from your end?
We came up with a good beginning, and we came up with a solid concept of where to go. I actually plan session to session. I don't have an ending in mind. Mm-hmm. My goal is just to see how long we can play and how long we can keep things going. I chose to kind of start it in the Clone Wars just because that was a good starting point. And I think that gives us very, very rich playground to play in because there's so many different avenues we could go in.
Yeah, I really like that you guys actually started pre-Clone Wars, and because that whole time period that everybody who doesn't like episode one tries to ignore in the Star Wars canon, like there's a lot of interesting stuff going on there. And you guys touch upon a lot of, you know, it's basically the height of the Jedi Order before they sort of, it's like the last sort of stable moment of the galaxy for a long, long while.
Yeah, I'm one of the few people that will tell you, I don't hate the prequels.
Yeah, I don't either. I think I'm a fan.
I think the prequels are a great story. I just don't think they were told necessarily in a great way.
Right. I could agree with that.
To me, there's so much in there and so much to pull from. So, but you mentioned you had an ending. So did you think about the ending and work backwards at all?
A little bit. So like I structured my big conspiracy that the players are making their way through where it's basically, it's a pyramid. It's a conspiramid. That's the term from Knights Black Agents. It's very, you know, trademark. But basically the idea is that at the top, there are the shadowy council, the small amount of people that are controlling it. And they're the ones at the top. My players start at the bottom and they're just following nodes. So it's sort of a funnel. I'm kind of funneling towards where the show is going to end up. And when I say I know where it's going to end, that might be a little bit presumptuous of me. I have an idea of how the final conflicts will sort of play out. It's not like I have the ending pre-written and I'm just going to hand a script to these guys and ask them to play through it by any means, but I'm guiding their choices and their avenues of reasonable investigation to a single small endpoint from where they started with a bunch of leads. They started, I think, with like 4 or 5 different leads, but as they follow them, they sort of consolidate into a narrower and narrower path. So I am sort of funneling them into where I feel like I want the ending to end up.
Okay, that makes sense. Since we do seasons, sometimes in a season, I'll think of a cool season ender, and then I'll think backwards to where we are and kind of think of the steps to get there.
Yeah, I do that on a sort of session-by-session scale. I often have a good idea of what I want the climax for a session to be, and then I kind of work backwards from there. So like during a session, I'm a little bit more detail-oriented as of a planner. I don't improvise a lot. We try to work together with this as to figure out what scenes should go where and in what order, which, you know, as they make choices that I don't expect or I get a better idea, I might shift those around and I might change the order up a little bit. But largely, it is a little bit on, I don't want to say on rails because railroading has such a negative connotation, but it's linear. I'll say that. Like,
yeah,
I think there's a certain style of gameplay that's really popular now, which is to play to find out what happens. And I don't know if I do that. I kind of know what's going to happen big picture, but those moments up to it, I think, are what's interesting for our show, at least.
Yeah, and I think, you know, pulling the curtain back a little more, every podcast kind of has to direct things a little more.
Right.
Playing to see how things play out in a podcast is probably a little more difficult than playing at a home game.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's difficult. It's definitely scarier, though. Like, it would suck to, you know, we're all adults and we find the one day a month that we can schedule to play and we sit down and play to find out what happens. And then we find out what happened wasn't that interesting. So,
yeah. Oh, for sure.
Yeah, usually the one thing I do like to plan, and I think we'll get into discussion of this later, but I like to end with a big zinger that is sort of a moral dilemma or gray area or choice that they have to make. And so up until the moment of that choice, I kind of know, I can anticipate pretty well what they're planning on doing. But once they get to that choice, I'm not assuming them to choose one way or another.
I do something very similar to that.
Do you have any examples of sort of how you've structured anything, or like, I guess, what does your GM notes like look like?
My GM notes, best way to describe it, look like bullet points.
Yeah.
Usually I try to come to the table with 5 to 10 good story points I want to hit, and then try to guide the story in that direction. Sometimes it works out, sometimes it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
we've had a few guests come on. That works out a little different with the planning. I have to sit down with them beforehand and discuss, okay, here's the character I want you to play.
Right.
Here's kind of the direction I'd like to see things go.
It's almost like you're casting somebody for a role, like a minor, a couple lines. Well, that sounds a little bit crueler than it might be, but, you know, you have to, they have to be aware of where they, their character stands in the story and what their agenda is and everything like that, I imagine.
Absolutely. You know, the first time I did it where I really had to kind of focus the characters in a direction is when I had Reese and Alar, and that was kind of A1 flashback. I had to say to them, there is a specific ending that we have to hit.
Yeah.
So that one was different because I had to be very, almost like a director going, oh, no, I need you to go this way now.
Yeah.
I need you to go that way.
Yeah. That always kind of feels weird at a play session. I totally understand that it is necessary sometimes. I kind of had a similar thing. This is just a little background so you understand the session, but one of my when you create a character in Legend of the Five Rings, which I guess I should mention, if you've never heard of my podcast, that's what I play. Sort of a samurai audio drama. It's Seven Samurai meets The Bourne Identity meets whatever else you want to throw in there. But at character creation, you have the option to roll on this table that gives you like a little mixed blessing type thing, right? So it gives you another little mechanic to your character creation. One of my players, Justin, he rolled up a character from the Scorpion Clan, and they're famous for their shinobi, their ninjas, right? And he had an ability that once per campaign, so once ever, he could call upon his allies in the shinobi, and they would do one favor for him, no questions asked.
Okay.
So he decided to use that favor. So instead of just narrating what happens, we decided to play it out because everyone wants to see, you know, a ninja action heist thing, right? But we knew it had to be successful. So large scale failure wasn't an option for that specific session. If you're looking for them, I think I called them, the episodes are called The White Towers and The Oni's Eye. They're at the end of season 2 for our show. But that was sort of our season finale. And going into that, we knew, and I communicated with the guys, like, mechanically, for his advantage to have worked, it has to work. So whatever you guys do, I'm probably going to give it to you, but like try to, you know, be reasonable. And those types of metagame conversations are a large part of AP podcasting, I think.
I think so too. A lot of talking in between sessions and a lot of where do we want the story to go? How do we want things to unfold? How do I want to help make sure your characters hit their goals? That kind of stuff.
Right.
I do a lot of that stuff in between.
We do too. We talk a lot about character arcs and like saying, hey, you know what? This season is coming to an end and you set this thing up early on and you haven't really followed up on it. Is that something that you want to fridge, or is that something that you want me to try to bring up this session and reintroduce it? Those sorts of like story structure things, I think, are the secret to podcast production in this sort of format that we play in.
Yeah, I agree 100%. I try to do that in a normal game though too, not just a podcast. In between sessions, talk to people.
Yeah.
Are there any specific tools you use when you plan? Like for me, I use Wikipedia to death.
Yes.
Because I need to research stuff. I want to make sure I'm as close to what Star Wars lore is as possible. Plus, it's kind of a free resource in a way because there's already all this knowledge and information out there that I can tap into.
And NPCs, locations. Yeah. There is an L5R wiki that I go to pretty frequently during prep. L5R was one of those fad games in the 90s. That's where it came from, where there was a meta plot with the RPG. And so there was a plot with NPCs that were advancing between editions and stuff, which is always a bad idea because that just makes the characters you play. I mean, you kind of run into that with Star Wars too. Like it's hard sometimes to run a story without them feeling like the off-brand Han, Luke, and Leia.
Absolutely.
And so L5R kind of has that in spades too. So I use, as far as like digital tools for like research, I use that mainly for like locations of being like, oh, they're probably going to be going to this castle. What's this castle's deal? And I can look at it and there might be a paragraph about like, oh, the walls of this castle can be shifted around to confuse the people in it. And I go, okay, I can run with that. But I don't dig usually deeper than that. I go there for inspiration, but luckily the canon stuff is pretty vague a lot of the time, so it gives you a lot of room to play within that.
I just knew that L5R is very heavy setting oriented.
Yeah.
So I didn't know too much about that.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. Like the setting oriented stuff is mainly with the social interactions of the game, of like the players are samurai and there are people that are higher status than them and they cannot question people of higher status than them. Also, there's this whole cast of people beneath them that they can basically do whatever they want to and no one will get in trouble. So it's less like having to hound the wiki for that type of stuff, because that's the kind of thing that's just sort of background that you just have to absorb to kind of be able to play in the playground. Like, that's sort of the equivalent of Star Wars, of being like, yep, there are hyperdrives and blasters and they've been around for thousands of years. Don't worry about it. Like, it's just part of the setting. Like, yeah. It's one of those things that you kind of just have to buy into to even get started, I think. But yeah, L5R can be pretty restrictive, but I'm a firm believer of throwing out the canon of the world whenever it gets in the way of the story that you want to tell.
I do that when I have to, but I try with Star Wars to stay as close as I can.
Right.
Just because I want to keep people immersed in that world.
You don't want to suddenly, you know, kill Count Dooku and have to rethink what the history of your Star Wars world is going to be, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
What do you think your strengths are when you plan things?
I think the things I'm good at and I've gotten better at over time is being able to try to hit on the show's themes at least once per session. So a big theme in ours is sort of where you are in your social standing and what it means to be born a samurai versus being born a peasant. And what is justice? Is justice doing the right thing, or is justice following the letter of the law? And that, like, those types of gray areas I think I've gotten pretty good at hitting. And then including recurring characters and stuff that come back every once in a while is something I just love doing, and I always am somehow able to justify why this fan favorite or player favorite NPC is suddenly, oh, of course, they're here now and they're back in the story for a session or two. What about you? What do you think? What do you take pride in?
My biggest thing is just learning the Star Wars lore, mm-hmm. and really embracing it. Mm-hmm. I love the Old Republic stuff. I think that would have been my second choice besides Clone Wars. Throwing them back in.
It's a good choice.
Yeah, throwing them back in with like the Brotherhood of Darkness and the Army of Light and all that neat stuff. Mm-hmm. I think another big part of my strength is really being able to communicate with my players.
Mm-hmm.
I'm lucky enough that the group I get to play with, if I know somebody's not going to be in a scene as a player, I can say, hey, can you play this NPC?
Yeah.
And then I can work with them. So that way they're not just sitting at the table staring at us.
Right.
I don't want to exclude a player. I'd rather include them. And it's something I've done for years.
Mm-hmm. I was going to ask you about that, because you guys are really into that sort of troupe style of theater or play, you know. It especially came up sort of towards the end of season 2 when you had the trial going on, or the almost trial with Carell, and you had, I believe, it sounded like you had both Michael and Nate doing each Jedi Master, right?
Correct.
How do you handle that? Because that's not something that we do. Usually I'm everybody else, so I don't know if it's maybe my players aren't feeling up to it, or if I've never prompted them to do it, but do you say, okay, you're going to be playing this Jedi Master, this is what their motivation is, this is what they want to get out of the scene, go, and you just sort of watch the scene in front of you?
Yes and no. I know that's not the greatest answer people love to hear, but so in that situation with Master Kukruk and Master Alshane, while we were sitting at the table, Mike had already kind of started playing Alshane. I actually had sent Nate a message over Facebook saying, hey, would you mind playing this Jedi? And I had found Kukruk online and researched him. And Nate was like, yeah, that's great. And part of the reason I did that to start with, aside from just I don't want them bored at the table, is I'm not the greatest at doing voices.
Mm.
I've got 3, maybe 4.
Yeah, same.
more when you add in sound effects.
Right.
So I wanted to add in a new voice and just help people kind of be immersed in the scene a little better.
Yeah, I think I have like 3 voices. I have like normal Tanner, and I have mean samurai Tanner, like a Can we swear on this?
Yeah.
Okay. I have asshole samurai Tanner. That's a tried and true trope that comes up. And then I also have like sniveling peasant Tanner, and like I just have to like go between those. And like in the most recent session, I'm trying to break out a little bit more, but it is kind of tricky to kind of get into that without, at this point, I shouldn't be self-conscious anymore. You know, I've been playing with my group for like a year and a half, but it's still kind of like, man, it sure would suck if I sounded stupid, so I'm going to play it safe and, you know, try to...
No, I get that a lot, too.
Yeah, one other thing I was going to ask you about is that, kind of going back a little bit to sort of how you guide your players, you have a GM PC in your game. You play A1, and he is often there as part of the party. Do you ever sort of use him as your voice, as your mouthpiece as the GM to try to influence them in certain ways? Or, I mean, most of the time he kind of sticks in the background, which I think is good for a GM PC to do. But what are your thoughts on sort of including that in a game?
I do at times use A1 to kind of drive the story. Back in season one, I had him bring out the slips of paper for the requisition form.
Yeah, and stuff like that.
That was actually brought out because at first I was like, man, we're getting real heavy and we're getting a lot of emotions. I want to kind of break the tension.
Yeah.
So I used him to break the tension. Mm-hmm. Since then, I kind of use him more as just a PC, and I try to think of him in a different headspace, so to speak. What would A1 want to do? What are his goals? And then I just treat him like another player at the table. It's a little tricky at times.
Yeah.
Because he knows, well, I should say I know, out of character knowledge that they don't know, so trying not to put that in sometimes gets hard.
Right. It's definitely tempting, and I've been tempted to during sort of investigations or times when my group is stalling and not really maybe picking up on what I intended them to do. And I really wish I had the chance to just have somebody be like, hey, have you considered this? And then just leaving it at that, because sometimes that's kind of all they need to get kicked back into it and everything. But yeah, I think you can go online and read horror stories about GM PCs stealing the spotlight. And I'm not obviously insinuating that you guys do that at all, no. But it is sort of a slippery slope of how much guiding / railroading, whatever you think railroading means, and how that involves with you having two voices at the table, sort of.
It's a delicate balance. And I think a big bonus I have is the players at the table. They're good at just interacting with A1 and treating him like another player. Mm-hmm. They don't treat it as, oh, this is the GM's player. They just treat him like he's another character on the show. So that's a real big help. You know, A1 wasn't intentionally designed to be a PC. He was designed to be spaced, so to speak.
Right. I kind of got that. I was like, I got the feeling of like, oh, this guy's still around. I got to give him, oh, what? I got to find a vocabulator for him now. Oh, Lord.
Yeah, you know, I used him to sabotage the ship and do some other stuff. I expected them to just, oh, out the airlock you go. But Nate decided, out of character, he wanted to kind of play around with my mind and see how I'd react if he embraced the character.
Oh, I see.
And I have no problem with that. I'll embrace it. Sweet, let's go. Now I have to figure out this NPC who's now a PC and try to develop him. A1, to be honest with you, isn't the hardest character for me to do, because I kind of modeled him after my son when he was younger.
Yeah.
So he's very literal. He's very kind of naive. It's nice because in the end of season 3, we got to kind of play around with the concept of emotions in a droid. Mm-hmm. And that's something I've always been intrigued with, because in Star Wars, I mean, C-3PO, oh my gosh, we're going to die.
Like, who programmed a droid with fear? Why are battle droids afraid? Don't you think that'd be the first thing they'd program out of them? Yeah.
Absolutely. So it was neat to kind of play around with that. And I've actually really enjoyed playing A1. I also use him sometimes to throw, you know, some moral stuff in there every now and then, mm-hmm. which that's fun to do.
Yeah. Like I really liked the part sort of where I just listened where he's very concerned about having his memory wiped, and like, yeah, if you think about that, that is a terrifying prospect for any sentient being to have. So I do think that you play him just right, because he's there to either provide color commentary or sort of help when need be, nudge the players in the right direction, or if they're doing too well and you need a story beat, he's just there to sort of throw a wrench in what they're doing and increase the drama a little bit, it seems like.
Yeah, he's fun to play.
Yeah. Kind of a side question to that. You roll a lot. It's, well, from what I can tell, obviously, and editing, the power of editing can take a lot of this out or put it in, but it seems that you roll a lot for your NPCs. Like, you roll dice to see what their odds of doing something are, or you roll to see if, like, if A1 can reprogram the ship systems or something like that. So, me personally, and obviously we have different sort of views on what the role of NPCs are in our campaign, but I try to roll as little as possible, and I usually just try to think of what the most interesting outcome is. Is the fact that you roll a lot, or if I'm completely off base, if you don't think I'm right, but is that something that you sort of see adding to the improvisational, more loose sort of nature of your show?
Generally, when you hear me rolling, it's either one of two things. If I'm using A1, I want to treat him like a PC.
Mm-hmm.
So I think to myself, would I have a PC roll to do this? And if the answer is yes, then I roll the dice so that it's the exact same thing. If it's an NPC rolling, it's generally because the story went in a little different direction than I was planning. So now I'm making it up on the spot, and I want to see kind of how is it going to work out narratively.
Interesting. So you're looking to surprise yourself a little bit with it.
Yeah. I want to see where is it going to go and how is it going to play out. I kind of do that in some ways to make it so that the PCs don't have to roll as much.
Mm.
So, for example, if I was going to have an NPC sneak up on them, I might roll just for his sneak versus their whoever has the highest perception. That way they're not all rolling perception checks.
Interesting. Okay. So now that we know whenever we hear an NPC rolling, it means that you're in panic mode a little bit and you're trying to get the story back on track. Is that what I'm hearing?
Maybe not full panic mode, but more curiosity mode.
Code yellow.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, I mean, I think that... I guess, do you roll publicly for NPCs and everything like that, or do you hide it behind the screen?
I have a screen up. The only reason I have a screen up is it's got all the charts I need.
Sure.
It's got the critical hit charts. It's got some random damage types up there, so if... You know, let's say one of the PCs decides to fall off the ship and fall, you know, 10 meters. I know what the damage is because there's a chart there. Mm-hmm. So I do roll behind that, which is funny. When I run a game at a convention, I lay the screen down flat and I roll right out in the open.
Right. I played about a year-long campaign of Edge of the Empire just for my home game. And I found that as the GM rolling publicly, it kind of helped. Oh, well, so obviously, you know, for an AP podcast, you have the power of editing and you can kind of take as long as you want to a certain extent to figure stuff out, and you can edit out the dead air. But like, I found it when I rolled, like, it was nice to have four other pairs of eyes and say, oh, no, you should do with this threat. Maybe this could happen, stuff like that. So are you sort of the one deciding that most of the time then for your NPCs?
Sometimes. Yes and no. Mm-hmm. A lot of times I just tell them what the result is. You know, I'm like, oh, I failed with two threats.
Mm-hmm.
And then I pause to see if anybody has any ideas. And then if not, then I take control of that. I'm not a fan of the concept of if the PCs roll threats, it's my job to determine what those threats are.
Right.
I think it should be cooperative.
I agree.
So
yeah,
I usually try to do it that way, which is funny because I find that the PCs usually, or I should say the players, usually come up with worse ideas than I did whenever there's threats and stuff.
I'm glad that all your players sort of have the mindset that, from what it seems like, that their characters are sort of action figures for them to play with and not necessarily like parts of themselves. Does that make sense? Like, it seems like there's a healthy separation of like, I can watch the game do a bad thing to this person I'm representing and not take it personally, or not take it like I'm interested to see how it turns out as much as I would be if I was a spectator.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, they do a great job of thinking about what's best for the story and not what's best for their character sometime.
Mm-hmm.
A good example of that is Mike spends more dark side points than I do usually.
I kind of picked up on that a little bit.
And part of that is just because I like to use the dark side points to introduce something new that they weren't expecting.
Mm-hmm.
And he likes to do the same thing, but he likes to do it so that it's something that nobody else was expecting.
Even you.
Including me.
Yeah,
exactly. So it's kind of fun. You know, I get the impression, though, listening with your show, because I've listened to all the episodes, that you guys do the same thing. I feel like your players are dedicated to what's best for the story.
Mm-hmm. There is a little bit that didn't come naturally for everybody at the table. No matter who you play with, you know, there's going to be people who feel differently about their characters than others, and some, like Justin's character, Bayushi, he is more than willing to put her into bad, god-awful situations and see if she can make it out alive and pick fights fights that she shouldn't be picking. Meanwhile, Dakota, who plays Kitsuki, he's a little bit more of a conservative player, and so me and him have had conversations in the past of, like, working out, hey, you know what, like, it's not always about the most optimal character moment to make. You kind of have to drive your characters like they're a stolen car a little bit, and watching them get banged up and stuff is half the fun. So me and him kind of went back and forth on that a little bit when the show started, but I think sort of once we got in our groove, I think he was much more willing to put his character in vulnerable spots. A good example of that is during our Winter Court arc, we had basically a dating game with him, where we introduced his character Kitsuki, who, you know, he's a samurai, he's 19 years old, why isn't he married with 3 kids already? So
yep.
We introduced a sort of the subplot to find him a wife, and so we role played 3 dates with him, and sorry Dakota if this is sort of letting the cat out of the bag, he did not want to do that. He felt like it would be too awkward. He's like, nobody's gonna want to listen to 2 dudes pretending to date each other, and I'm like, you haven't been on the internet clearly. But
yeah.
But I mean, I'm glad that I managed, or that he, you know, decided to take a risk and opt into it, because some of the feedback I get about that arc is that, like, yeah, that was some of the most rich role playing and character defining moments of being like, what is Kitsuki about? What does he look for in a wife or a partner for the rest of his life? And, you know, we even put a twist on that very recently of, maybe why do you have to pick just one? You know, it's not something that is always natural, but it's good to kind of put yourself in vulnerable spots and take risks as a player, I think.
Oh, for sure. It can sometimes be intimidating to get vulnerable at a table.
Mm-hmm.
I know the first time that Mike and I, because Mike used to sit straight across from me at the table,
mm-hmm.
and the first time we got into a really emotional scene, we locked eyes.
Ooh.
And we both got in this moment where we both started to tear up, and it was all about when his dad came back and we were dropping him off back on Tula, and then his dad, like, hugs him and, you know, says basically, I love you. And Mike and I both started tearing up, and I had to turn my head and look away.
Right. There's some hardcore moments like that. And, like, it's crazy. So we don't play face to face. I don't know if your listeners know that, but we play on Roll20. We don't even play with, video chat on. It's just our voices. And I think that helps that disconnect, because we get into some heavy, heavy stuff in Shadow of the Cabal. Like,
for sure.
Like, oh, is torture worth it? What's the cost of a peasant's life compared to yours, or compared to doing the right thing? And, like, there's moments where we've gotten emotional, and I can only imagine at a real table where, you know, you could be even that much more intimidated by having to be face to face, or, you know, be self-conscious if I'm trying to pretend to go on a date with somebody. Sometimes that barrier of it's just a voice on the other end of the line is healthy.
Yeah, I'm not sure how I would react not seeing the person. I'm not sure which way would be easier for me.
Yeah, and I mean, like, I grew up playing, you know, in person, just around real tables and stuff, but I just think for what we do, video just... So we're going to be playing remotely no matter what, so we're not playing face-to-face. You can read plenty of opinions online of what's better of face-to-face or versus internet, you know, remote play. I don't find them to be that different to me in my feelings. I think there is sort of an energy that you can tap into at a real table, but for me personally, it's not that big of a deal breaker. You know, if we're going to be playing remotely anyway, I just think for what we're doing, webcam video probably doesn't add a ton, and it's okay to just sort of talk to one another. We're going to try mixing that up a little bit, I think, with our next campaign, but as for right now, I think we feel like we're doing fine with it, so.
Well, I've done both. I've done a lot of online gaming with the RPG Academy and a couple other shows. The biggest thing I think I've noticed is when you sit down in front of a computer, you end up a little more focused, and there's a whole lot less side conversations and joking around. And
right, because you can't really whisper and have a conversation with someone. It's just, it's on the channel or it's not, you know?
Yeah, or you can't reach over and flick somebody's knee in an uncomfortable way, you know, to make them kind of react.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's kind of neat.
Going back a little bit, so we talked about what we feel our strengths are. What do you feel like you talked about your character voices. What else do you feel like? Are there any other weaknesses that you think sort of crop up that you notice?
For me, I know that one of my weaknesses, and it's something I've worked on, is getting more descriptive. For me, I like to, you know, oh, you see this NPC, he walks in, you know, he's a big guy, he's got, you know, brown hair and blue eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And then people go, well, what is he wearing? What is he carrying as a weapon? And I'm like, you know, my brain says, leave it vague and let you fill it in.
Yeah.
So I've worked on trying to be more descriptive. I try to do that in my planning too. I try to go, okay, they're going to go to this place, have a name ready, have a description of that place, like the season 3 ender where they were in front of a theater.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's have a name for the theater. Let's have a description of the statue that's going to be up there. And we got so much into the scene that I forgot to get real descriptive as far as the statue.
Yeah.
Up until the moment came where I had to use the statue, and then I was like, oh. At the table, I kind of scratched my head and went, crap, I was supposed to describe this to begin with, but I don't think it'll take us out if I throw it off the top anyway. So.
Yeah, yeah.
What about you? Anything you want to work on?
Yeah, I think I struggle with getting formulaic with my adventure and session design a little bit, I think. I think a lot of the objectives that the players have in a given session might be like, oh, figure out what's going on here, or hunt down this person and get answers from them. And like the path from the start of the game to the end of the game, I have a hard time making one session that has a similar goal different from another. Like, for example, my players right now are in the most recent episode that aired. They're in the capital of Rokugan trying to hunt down somebody. And we've had in the past sessions where they're in a large urban environment where they have to hunt somebody down. And me personally, I've kind of felt like both of them have been flops a little bit in my eyes, and that they're just not super engaging, or, you know, like I had a formula and it didn't work and I couldn't figure out how to get out of it. And I think that that's sort of an issue. For example, in Star Wars, you can kind of think a little bit more laterally. The world's a little bit bigger. There's more options for a given player character. You know, like they could get in their ship and jump into hyperspace and go wherever they want, theoretically, right?
Absolutely. I agree.
So it's kind of trickier. The options that my players have are a little bit, just because we were talking about with more rigid social society of Rokugan, it's a little bit more rigid what their options are. So I kind of struggle to make it dynamic from session to session, I think.
I see what you're saying. I agree. Star Wars, more of a sandbox in a lot of ways. It's funny because the players are always joking with me going, why do you keep picking planets that have ice on them? Well, I only picked one, technically. Naos 3 was actually picked by Nate, not by me.
You assholes picked the rest of them.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
One thing I really like that you do really well is the moral dilemmas. You hit them with some moral dilemmas and I'm like, wow. Like, the one that jumps out in my head, they had just defeated some pirates and found a bunch of money. And you said, oh, well, you now have to go tell on the village, which means that all these people are going to die and the money gets returned.
Yeah.
And I felt like the players just went, oh, man, we're going to be responsible for slaughtering a whole village now. But yet we have to go tell because that's what a samurai would do. Like, I could feel almost like this tension between the players going, how do we find a way around getting all these people killed?
You audio listeners can't hear, but my eyes are lighting up and I have a huge grin on my face because this is definitely my favorite part of my show. And I thank you for the compliment. I work pretty hard on making those, and I love those types of moral dilemmas. And I think that Rokugan is a world that it's completely unrealistic in that it's set up to make those moral dilemmas all the time. No reasonable human being could ever live in that world without having to commit seppuku at some point in their life. But it's a game world. So like we can explore basically every law and everything is set up like a house of cards. And when you want to pull one card, you're going to have to, you know, pull the whole house down. And that one was one that I was really proud of as well. And some of them are intentionally planned, Like that one, I very much threw in the twist right at the end there of like, oh, you thought you had this one figured out, huh? It was all going to be so easy. Here you go. But sometimes they happen organically just from the way that Rokugan society comes up. For example, in a couple episodes before the one that you were talking about, they were sent to investigate this dockyard, this huge island where all these ships were being built for all these different clans in Rokugan. And during their investigation, they found out that the leader of the city was dirty, or they were taking money from pirates, right? It was the same arc as the one that you were talking about.
Yep, I remember.
They figure out that the right thing to do would be to call an investigation on the whole city from the top down, which would completely halt all the shipbuilding going on and halt all the commerce going in and out of the city until the law enforcement officials could figure out who's dirty, who's not, and clean the place up. That's not something I had in mind at all.
Nice.
Once Dakota, or maybe it was Dakota or Ryan, but they said, oh, we should definitely report to the clan champion that this is going wrong, I thought, oh man, that sure would shut down this port for a while, huh? And so then they would, of course, have to make that decision knowing that someday courtiers from the other clans are going to be harassing them in the court of, hey, why did you rob thousands of hours of Koku worth of money from us as you shut down this port to ferret out one dirty shipbuilder or something like that? So now that one hasn't come back to burn them yet. It's in the plans.
Yet.
I have a Google Doc full of loose plot threads that I want to come back and bite them in the ass at some point. Because they just happen. They just create them as they go. I'm sure you might do something similar, if not as formally.
I do. Yep.
Yeah. Like for example, like when they went back to Tula and you're like, oh yeah, didn't Corel viciously murder somebody there? Oh, okay. That's kind of one that I detected that me and you had a sort of matching of wavelengths on of like, yeah, this is, I'd do this move.
That was kind of two different ideas going on there. One, I wanted to kind of reinforce to Kendall that, hey, you are playing a moral character. You're supposed to be a failed Padawan, so you're supposed to still have some of that goody-goody in you, so to speak. And as a player, I want you kind of remind you of that. At the same time, I thought it would be a good shock to the players, and I wanted to see how they would react.
Yeah, because there's never a scene in Star Wars where, oh, someone has to answer to the law enforcement officials about what they did, but that's such a cool wrench to throw into a genre that usually doesn't care about that.
Yeah, I wanted to throw something completely unexpected at them and see how they reacted.
Yeah, and that's a large part of my prep too. As structured as it is, I always like to try to include at least one problem that I don't have a solution for. And just say, surprise me, figure it out. One example of that is during the first sort of couple episodes of our Winter Court arc, we knew that we were going to be in one location for an extended period of time. Basically in Rokugan, when the winter snows fall, everyone holds up in a castle and schemes with each other and against each other, right? So I wanted to get them into the mindset of, okay, you can't just kill and interrogate your way through this one. You kind of have to play the Game of Thrones, so to speak. So I introduced the character of this ghost who gave the players this sort of quest that if you don't find a way to ruin the reputation of this one random guy, I'm going to bring this whole castle down into the sea. And so I had no idea what, I didn't plan any like, oh, this is a route that they could take, or maybe they could do this. That was definitely a give them an interesting situation and let them figure it out kind of deal. Which it seems like you kind of... Sorry, I was just going to say, it seems like you kind of do that a lot, though.
I do. Part of that is just because that's what my players ask me to do.
Mm-hmm.
They want me to throw new things at them and challenges and see how they react to it. And that's fun to me. The advantage I have in that situation is my players embrace that and they love it.
Mm-hmm.
How do your players react to stuff like that?
I think that it can definitely be a little bit of a change of pace because they're used to, like I said, it's kind of the moment when I shift from a more linear structured type story to a, okay guys, how's this session going to end? You figure it out. You write the finale for this one. You know, usually I like to say very upfront, like, hey, just so you guys know, I don't have an answer planned for this. Don't feel like you're missing out on some clues or getting frustrated on that. This is specifically for you guys to figure out and decide how you want to do it. And if it's reasonable, I'll let it fly and we'll tell a good story together. But usually the best strategy is just the sort of pause and talk about expectations and that I'm not expecting them to find my secret plot and, oh, damn, you guys didn't. You ruined the session. I don't want them to feel like that or to feel like they're missing something. I want them to have the freedom to do what they want.
Nice.
Metagame conversations, yeah, are just so, so valuable.
With the different things you kind of throw at the players, how do you keep them hidden? Do you give them clues or do you just throw it at them?
When it comes to like the twists and stuff like that, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, usually, like I said, Rokugan is such a structured society that usually you don't need a big twist. You don't need to introduce a huge element to make a big twist, I think. If you introduce a very slight random, quote-unquote random, I planned it the whole time, random complication into the mix, it can really, like we said, it's nice when they think they have it all figured out, and then I throw one little twist in it. One of the examples I'm proud of with that is in our episode 26, where they were basically trapped in a spirit realm with the monstrous remains of a starving peasant. And they figure out this monster. They figure out, oh, okay, he was trying to break the curse. He did some bad things, but God, wouldn't any of us do that if we were in this horrific situation and we were afflicted by this ghost? And then they were like, okay. And then I could detect that they were going to basically let him free or let him join the monks and not pay for his crimes, right? And then okay. I introduced the twist that I improvised. I'm specifically proud of this one, that they found a katana stuck under one of his floorboards, which implies that one of the people that he killed in his desperation to break the curse was a samurai.
Ooh, that's not good.
No, it is not. And so it's now suddenly they have to decide, well, by golly, the dude just got the worst luck in the world and he happened to kill a samurai. Like, how can we in good conscience let this dude free or let him go and without it coming back to us? Because we would be accomplices at that point.
Okay.
And we would be knowing of this murder if we didn't say anything about it. So with that, the twist was literally a single item that they were going to find or that I decided that they would find. There was really kind of no way to see that coming, but I don't mind that. I designed that adventure that they couldn't have gotten that twist any earlier than it did. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because they'd never want to search under a peasant's floorboards. Why would they ever do that? Oh, I'm only going to reveal, you noticed something under the floorboard at this time that you didn't notice before. So that's sort of one of my cheats as a game master, so to speak, that I'm not really running a simulationist world where they could have interacted with that.
Which is funny you bring that up as an example, because when I was listening to that episode, I thought to myself, he didn't have them roll to notice this. It was just kind of like, you now notice this. And like, as soon as you said that, I was like, uh-oh, plot point, something big's going to happen.
Right. I think that you bring up a really good point of when do you call for rolls for plot to happen and when don't you?
For me, I'm a big fan of the story kind of dictates when the rules are going to be brought in, not mm-hmm. the other way around. I know some people like to roll a lot of dice and have the rules kind of dictate the story. I don't. Good examples of that are social situations. Rarely do I call for a roll when they're doing social stuff. The only time I would do that is if they change kind of their tone. Mm-hmm. So if they're charming somebody and then decide to go, I'm going to shoot you in the knee if you don't give me the information. Then I'm like, you're going to roll.
Right.
I try not to have them roll dice. Obviously, combat, you can't avoid it. It's things like computers checks, perception checks, that kind of stuff. They have to roll dice. I prefer just to let the story kind of organically grow.
Mm-hmm.
The less dice rolling, the more role-playing.
That's
kind of my theory.
Yeah, and like, for example, when you called out, you know, like they didn't have to make a roll to find that that katana under the floorboards. In my mind, I thought, what's going to be more interesting if I just give it to them or I make them roll for it and they possibly miss it and then that whole avenue of the story is never explored. I thought what is the most interesting situation that could happen is that they would find it. So why roll for it? And like, I think that as if you're listening to this and you're kind of struggling with your sessions sort of falling flat, consider not calling rolls for things that are interesting to happen. And, or it's kind of like it kind of fits into the rule of cool a little bit.
Absolutely. See, I have the advantage. Star Wars has a built-in mechanic for that.
Right.
The destiny pool. Mm-hmm. I can always flip over a dark side point. Situation like you talked about.
Oh, that's a dark side moment. Totally.
Absolutely. Dark side point. You notice this lightsaber hilt underneath the floorboards. You know this person slaughtered a Jedi.
Mm-hmm.
For me, there's a built-in mechanic. I don't always use that. Sometimes, though, and I don't know if you ever run into this, sometimes my players, I could tell they just kind of want to roll dice.
Right.
It's been a while. I want to roll the dice. Let me do something with my character sheet.
Yeah.
Nice thing for me is Star Wars has a built-in mechanic for that, too.
Yeah, I am not so lucky.
It's a simple check. Yeah, it's a simple check. One difficulty. Oh, you're rolling three yellows and a, you know, one green. Yeah, roll against one purple. You're going to succeed.
Right.
You know, it gives them that moment of they can roll the dice and they can feel like, okay, I did something.
Yeah, in my time with Star Wars, I definitely noticed that, too, that I prepared for Edge of the Empire in a completely different way than I prepare for any other game, which is, like you said, I have a bullet-pointed list, and I can count on the dice to do a lot of the heavy lifting when it comes to what is the moment-to-moment story going to be. And in L5R, which is a crusty old game steeped in 90s game design, I don't have that opportunity. I wish I did, but it's a little bit harder because you're a little bit more on your own. And like Star Wars, the Fantasy Flight Star Wars, they have a great GM section in there telling you about when to use force points, how to flip light side, dark side points, how to use advantages. And God, L5R's GM advice section is just god awful. It's just like, oh, make a samurai drama. You know how those work, right?
Yeah, everybody knows how those work.
Right. Like, they don't even, they're like, oh, hey, if you don't know, just watch Seven Samurai. Here's some movies to watch. But, like, it doesn't explain why those moments work. And it really, I think with Star Wars, I think it's very clear if you listen to Redemption that the dice are there to move the story forward. And you would not have the story that you have without those dice.
100% agree with you.
I don't think that's the case for Shadow of the Cabal. I think you could inject any number of resolution mechanics and the story wouldn't feel that different, I think. I don't know. How do you feel about that?
I don't know. You don't have them roll dice a ton, so I don't feel like the mechanics bog down the story.
Right.
And you roll everything through an app, right? You're not rolling actual physical dice, correct?
Correct. Yeah, we use a digital dice roller.
Okay, which my understanding means you're not rolling a handful of D10s and trying to figure out which ones to keep.
Yeah.
Which definitely keeps it flowing and keeps it going smoother. I don't know. I might tend to disagree in a way because the mechanics are what they are in that setting and for that system, which works.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you try to do the same thing in Fantasy Flight games, you'd have the same results.
Which is kind of interesting because our next campaign is going to be in 5th edition L5R, which is not out yet, but they've done some pretty heavy beta coverage, and it is by Fantasy Flight, and it does use some funny dice, and we're going to have to get used to interpreting dice pools a little bit, which is not something you had to do in 4th edition. It's just get high, pick the high numbers, try to get the highest number.
Yeah.
And in the new system, it much like Star Wars, it's like, okay, I have two opportunities and three strife. A, what am I going to do with these? And B, what does this look like in the narrative? What does this represent as far as what the camera sees?
You guys have done the beta testing already, and I didn't feel like you guys really had any issues with it. Of course, that could be the magic of editing. How do you feel you guys did with it?
I think we've gotten better. We've played it off mic a couple times just because we kind of want to be able to hit the ground running when it comes out and not have to learn it as we produce an AP show with it.
So don't do what we did.
I think you guys did fine. But yeah, I don't know. I think that it's definitely It's hard to say because the beta was very not intuitively laid out. So I don't know how much of it is the system versus the presentation. So I'm going to have to see how that shakes out. But we've already talked about some tools that we're going to implement to sort of make life easier and stuff like that. One thing that I like that the beta does compared to Star Wars, for example, is that in Star Wars, if you get two advantages and two threats, or I'm sorry, two successes and two threats on a die pool, right?
Okay.
The game implies that you're sort of obligated to use those two threats. Now, I've never met a table that didn't just ignore when it didn't make sense, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, but in L5R, the new edition, they specifically said, hey, if you don't have an idea for an opportunity right at the front of your brain, don't worry about it. Don't even keep the die that has the opportunity on it. So it seems like they've kind of learned from Star Wars a little bit of maybe like, oh, I succeeded, but I have five advantages and I feel like it's a waste if I don't use all five of these advantages. I don't know. Do you guys ever run into that? Like, obviously, like you said, you ignore the dice when they get in the way. So I don't know how much that really...
That happens all the time. Social checks, since we don't do a ton of them. If I try to charm your character and I succeed, I've succeeded. How can I then have another advantage on top of that? I've already convinced you to do what I want you to do.
Right.
There are times when we will disregard that. For me, it's more things like mechanics checks. Hey, the ship took damage. Roll. Well, your successes fix the hull damage. Your advantages, you can use those to fix strain on the ship. What else could you use them for?
Right. It seems like the least interesting option sometimes.
Absolutely. And that's where we've tried to think about it. We're like, just fix the strain. We're not going to worry about it. Mm-hmm. Or computers checks. Those are another one that I rolled and I succeeded. I have one threat. What would my threat be? My check was to hack in and not get caught. How could I then have a threat? Like, I succeeded at not getting caught. So there are times when I just look at it, I'm like, I can't think of what to do with the threat. Let's just move on.
Right. And I think that that's sort of where the gamey part of the role-playing game comes in. But obviously, you and I do not play role-playing games for their intended purpose, I would say.
I would agree. Both like to just, let's tell a great story and kind of utilize the rules to help tell that story versus the rules driving the story.
Right.
And that is a big difference in my mind, because I have played at tables where the game master is pretty much telling you got to have a die in your hand ready to roll for 50 things, and that bores me after 10 minutes, because I know I don't have as much control over my character as I should have. The dice are going to dictate some of it.
Right, and that is definitely a sort of quandary that we run into a lot of, like, it's kind of like what you're talking about with social checks, like, hey, if I am a character that is pretty decent at courtier, which is sort of the diplomacy of L5R. Even if I'm not a great role player and I don't really know what to say in this situation, can I roll and my character says something more interesting? And like that kind of stuff is always hard to adjudicate, even at a home table, you know, like where is the line between what you simulate with your voice versus what your character is?
Absolutely. I used to tell people, especially social situations, if you know what the NPC's hot buttons are and we role play through it, I'm not going to make you roll the dice. Mm-hmm. Now, if you as a player are a shy person and you're not naturally a charming person and you're not sure what to say, then before we go on the scene, we can roll the dice and we'll let the dice kind of dictate how the scene's going to go. Then we can go through and actually role play through the scene.
Yeah, that's what we often have run into where... Because, I mean, I think everybody's had that moment at a tabletop RPG where you're playing D&D and you let out a stunning speech to convince the king to let you go and you roll a 2. And it's like, well, maybe we should have rolled the die first and then I should have narrated my thing after. And like, that's not an intuitive moment. And that's a hang up that I'm sure if you're listening to this, you've probably run into something similar of like, oh, I have a cool idea. Too bad the dice didn't agree with me on this one. So it is all about like the balance of the dice are there because of randomness and to introduce interesting things into the story that nobody was expecting.
Yes. I couldn't agree more.
And that is where their purpose begins and ends. And anything outside of that, I think you should really just sort of, at least for our enterprise, what we're doing, trying to tell a story for an audience, you should probably just pick the most interesting option or just role play it out however you want to think of it.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I remember playing a bard that had lots of diplomacy and talking to a king, and all of a sudden, you know, we spent half an hour role playing through this scene, and I'm like, this is great. And the game master's like, roll the die. And I rolled a 1. Oh, you fail. But this is what my character does. This is the whole point of the character. And my other thought was, why did we just spend a half hour role playing through this if the die was going to determine it in the end anyways?
Right.
So that stuck in my head for years. So I've never done that to players. I'm like, if you as a player come up with this really cool and intense scene, no dice rolling. You've succeeded or failed based on the role playing, and we're going to move on. And for me, the advantage I have at my table is, especially Mike, he's playing an awkward character. Tazi is not a social character.
And we could all agree that in real life, Mike is just an awkward dude. He just doesn't get along with people.
Oh, yeah. He's the jerk of the group. Just kidding, Mike. You are probably the nicest guy I've ever met. One of the nicest guys. But Mike is good at playing that awkward moment, and if he feels like it would fit the scene and fit the character, he'll slip up purposely, and I can see him kind of smile before he does it and go, ha-ha, here's where I tank the scene, so to speak. Not truly tank it, but I'm going to throw something in here that's a little awkward and make it worse than it should be. And I love those scenes. I high-five Mike when he does it. And I have a lot of fun with it.
We kind of do a similar thing sometimes when Justin's character, Bayushi. So Justin, as a player, he's sort of a more wallflower type player, too. He's definitely content to not have to be in every scene or even have to fire in every once in a while. He's very content to just sort of think about what he does. And then, by God, he's going to do it once he gets going. You can't stop him. But, you know, he picks his moments. But I love like what you're talking about with Mike sort of intentionally bungling himself up. It's so funny when we have Bayushi, who's just, she's kind of a sociopath. Like, she's kind of just a little bit. Yeah, she's not all there. But like when we try to have her, when she somehow once in a blue moon gets forced to make a social role, I'm just like, Justin, in what way is Bayushi a total creepazoid in this scene? And then he just narrates something great of like, oh, I just look at her until she either meets my gaze or doesn't, and then I hold the gaze for a little bit too long before going on. And intentionally making your character sort of inept is so much fun, I think.
Absolutely. It keeps you in the game, too. And I think it makes it more entertaining.
So when you guys are playing and you guys are sort of, you're actively generating results on dice rolls, say in combat, something high action where there's going to be a lot of description, do you ever have to sort of like prompt your players to say, hey, what does this look like? Or are they enough in the moment to sort of do that? Or are they just sort of in math mode at that point? And you have to sort of bring them into the game again.
It's usually the opposite. They're usually reminding me to be more descriptive. And when they roll and I'm like, okay, that's enough to kill them, my brain is already kind of set to move on to the next PC. Mm-hmm. They then sometimes will have to say, oh, great, this is what it looks like. And then they narrate it. That's one of the things I'm working on, is being more conscious of saying, what does that look like?
Yeah.
And that's why I've started switching to some of the other games like Feng Shui and Dungeon World, where it's built into the mechanics to say that to people.
Mm-hmm.
Mike and Kendall and Emily do a great job of describing how they do things and how it looks. I've learned to just say, that's enough to take the person out. How does it look? Or sometimes I just hand signals at the table where I just kind of look at him and do the whole kind of finger across the neck thing, and they know that they've taken him out.
Right.
I do still like, if they got a critical hit, to let them roll it, because it's kind of neat to look at the chart and go, oh, okay, well, your critical hit's enough to knock them back and it takes them out. How do you want to narrate that?
It becomes sort of a scenes from a hat improv prompt at that point.
Absolutely. That's the fun thing for them sometimes, to remind me to be more descriptive, because I do get caught up sometimes in the combat of, okay, this NPC is now dead, next PC, like I'm crossing things off my list and redoing the math on my sheet.
Uh-huh.
I try as much as I can to have all that written up beforehand, like the NPCs, the combats.
Right.
Not all the time. Sometimes the random ones come up.
I mean, it's tough as the GM anytime, though, because you're wearing a lot of hats. You have to be not only the director, you have to be the set designer, you have to be the choreographer, you have to be crunching the numbers behind the scenes. So it is easy to sort of slip up and not immediately have the instinct to jump into what does this look like. That's a prompt I give my players a lot of. I kind of have the opposite issue where I'm the one who edits the show.
Okay.
So I know what sounds good and what doesn't, and what things I think of when editing. I'm like, man, I wish I would have said this at this time. Whatever. Let's move on with it. So I kind of am, I'm editing the show in my mind while we play, or thinking about how this is going to turn out in the edit. So I will often say to my players, who, God bless their hearts, they've never had to edit an action scene together. They help me out in other ways, but that's not one of them. I'll have to prompt Dakota. I'm like, okay, Kitsuki, you take out two mooks with this one attack roll. What does this look like? And then Dakota thinks for a second, and then he launches into this sick Jackie Chan stunt choreography move. But then what I do, here's behind the actor screen, is that I cut out me asking the question. So then it sounds like we're all really good, but we're not. We're so bad. We have to remind each other constantly. But when you remove those prompts, suddenly we sound like the best group in the world. And like, oh, wow. Look how good these guys are at role-playing. A lot of that is post-production magic.
Yeah. I'm lucky because Kendall does a lot of the editing. I shouldn't say a lot. He does probably 99% of the editing. I usually work on bonus episodes and that kind of stuff. I do think, as a GM, it's good to do the editing. I notice when I edit something, I'm sitting there going, wow, I really like the word interesting all of a sudden.
Ooh, yep. I've done that too, yeah.
You start catching all the ums and ahs and pauses that you do. So I think it's helped me be a better game master because I start thinking about that kind of stuff before I speak.
Right. Any sort of it's an ounce of prevention is a pound of cure. You know, any thing that you do to make your life easier during gameplay will save your ass three times over in editing, I think.
Yeah. And see, like for me, even with Kendall doing the editing, I will actually listen to the show once it's been sent out. Generally a couple of times. The first time I listen to it is to pay attention to things that happened at the table that I don't remember. Like maybe KO said something funny over here. I write it down.
Mm-hmm.
Or, oh, Tazi made a comment about this. So then I make a little note so I can bring it up later. And then the second time I usually listen to it, I usually do kind of a Mystery Science Theater 3000 thing in my own head.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of make fun of us. But that's just my own guilty pleasure.
There's definitely times before we switched to a bi-weekly release schedule and we were releasing weekly, which by God were our darkest days. There were times where I was just so fed up. Like I caught myself when I was muting people's tracks of like Ryan was shifting in his seat and I just thought to myself, shut up, Ryan, shut up. I'm going to mute you. And that's when I knew, maybe I need to cool it a little bit and have some break time in between here so I don't end up hating my players and their stupid mouths.
Yes, absolutely. And that's, I mean, part of the reason why we do bi-weekly. Mm-hmm. It gives Kendall more time to work on editing and putting in the sound effects. And he does a phenomenal job. I've, like I said, played around with it a little bit. Nowhere near what he does.
Right. It sounds like a Star Wars audiobook. Have you ever listened to any of the Star Wars audiobooks?
A ton of them.
It's like a radio drama, basically.
That was one of our goals when we started it. We wanted to separate ourselves from other podcasts because a lot of other APs, it's just, hey, maybe it's four people sitting around a table playing. We wanted to get more immersive in the story and more with the radio drama style. Mm-hmm. I listen to a lot of books on tape, but I have a job where I sit at a desk all day. I do billing for a medical supply company. I've got 9 hours a day where I can put in headphones and listen to whatever I want.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of podcasts, a lot of books on tape. I specifically have listened to a lot of Star Wars ones so I could kind of grab ideas to put into our storyline. Like the whole Darth Plagueis thing that came up with Isla's character, or I should say with Emily's character Isla, is because I had just finished the Plagueis book.
Yeah.
I was like, huh, there was a lot of cool stuff in here. And this happened just before the Clone Wars, which ties in with her character losing her memory, which originally Isla was only supposed to be there for a short while. I had a request from one of our Patreons to put romance in the story, and I kind of scratched my head. I'm like, how do I have romance at a table with four straight dudes?
I can show you a lot of fan fictions that will answer that question for you, Chris.
But I was like, Corell, no interest in any kind of relationship because she's the ex-Padawan. Kao is just kind of Kao. I didn't think he would take it serious. I'm like, and then Tazi's awkward. And then it clicked in my head. I'm going to make somebody just as awkward as Tazi.
Nice.
So you have two awkward interactions. So it can be awkward. And because it's two guys role-playing it, it can be even more awkward. And it was fun at the table. And then we asked Emily to kind of come along. I said, all right, do you want to keep playing Isla? Do you want to play something else? And she's like, well, I like the concept of seeing how that relationship builds, but I kind of want to make Isla my own. And that's when I was like, let's wipe her memory and we'll create a backstory. We can create a personality. Like, we can basically hit reset on the character.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where it came up with. And then I said to Emily, how much of her backstory do you want to know? And she just kind of smiled and said, surprise me.
That's the sign of a great, great player. Like, you can't ask for a better player than that.
Yeah, I was like, fair enough. And we set some boundaries. Like, I have some boundaries. Like, there was going to be no, like, abuse in the past.
Right,
like,
right.
It's Star Wars. The only kind of, quote, abuse would be, oh, you were a Sith apprentice. Well, guess what? They were pretty rough on their apprentices, so you might get beat up a little bit, but nothing.
Star Wars keeps it pretty PG-13, yeah.
Absolutely. So we did set some boundaries and stayed within those.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to give her a little bit of a dark past to see how would Corell react to that.
Yeah.
Tazi, I knew Tazi, he don't care.
I love A1, how force dumb sure. Tazi is. I love, because, I mean, you guys all know a lot about Star Wars, obviously. And I love every time when Michael, who knows a lot about Star Wars, is like, what's all this stuff with the force about? And like, I love when people play beneath their mental limits. I don't know if that's the right term, but they play a character who does not have knowledge as they have, and they revel in being so ignorant to it. I love that. It's always a fun trope, I think.
Yeah. All three of the players do a great job of keeping out-of-character knowledge separate from in-character knowledge. And there are times at the table where that comes up where, you know, like when I first mentioned Hugo Damask, Kendall looked over at me and went, really? And I was like, yes. And Emily's like, who's that? And Kendall went, oh, you'll find out. And he didn't bring it into the game at all. He let it just kind of develop organically, which is really good. And I talked to Kendall later. I'm like, I didn't think you'd recognize that name. And he's like, I read the book. I'm like, oh, fair enough. Well, thanks for not spoiling it at the table, so that way we can develop it. So
I kind of had a similar thing. Yeah, when I first introduced the idea of the Kolot conspiracy, Dakota and Justin were not well-versed in L5R lore enough to know what the implication of that was. Ryan has been playing L5R for probably about 10 years on and off, so he knows what their deal is and everything. And once that happened, he saw the writing on the wall and said, oh, this is going to be a Kolot campaign. Because I did not tell them that beforehand. I told them this is going to be an investigation and mystery heavy campaign. Which,
nice.
I'm not entirely a liar in that. It's a little bit more action, intrigue, thriller, I would say.
Yeah. You have a good mix of all of that in the story. I enjoy that part of it. I really enjoy it. You guys do so much of the role-playing, and yet you cut out role-playing that is described but doesn't need it to be too descriptive. Like, I think you've described it before. Oh, you walk in and you meet this person. There's a half hour of bowing before you guys actually talk. How does the talk go?
Right. And like, that's something that can be fun to play at a table, but is not fun to listen to for the 10th time. Like, every samurai, like, even when they get into town, it's not like, and you can listen to this in the first couple episodes, they're like, oh, where is the inn? I want to find the inn. Let's find a good place to stay. What's around? Can we keep an eye on stuff? Who's the innkeeper? Does he know anything? And now I'm just like, you guys find an inn and you get some rooms there. They're comfortable, but not too comfortable. And you guys are back on the street. What else do you want to do? And like, being able to sort of summarize that and
yep.
Skip past the montage-worthy stuff, I think. So I think that you and I are both very similar in that we, like you mentioned, you play Feng Shui, you play a bunch of other different games. Do you ever get inspiration from different games or mechanics or even like stories or other APs that you bring to Redemption? Like, do you ever hack any of your rules at Redemption, or do you ever keep in mind principles from one game to bring into Star Wars?
I do. A good example of that is like astrogation checks. They're there to help you jump through hyperspace. You don't go through a moon and blow yourself up. First time we were in combat and they're like, oh, we're just going to jump to light speed. There's no rules on doing astrogation checks in combat. I then said, well, let me steal something from, I think it's 4th edition D&D, where you have to have a certain number of successful checks before you can succeed.
Oh, yeah, like a skill challenge, kind of.
Yeah, I was like, so however many rounds it takes you to get 3 successful checks on astrogation, then you can jump to hyperspace. And that's what we've gone with, and it's worked out pretty well, because cinematically that makes sense. You're getting shot, you know, the ship's getting some damage. That can increase the difficulty based on what's going on, or it could make it easier if Tazi does some good piloting and they don't get shot, which usually he does a good job at the piloting. I usually do a good job at shooting the ship. I don't usually do a good job at hitting the characters, but the ship I can beat up every day.
Yeah.
So I do steal some of that. Doing a lot of that, like Dungeon World, has really started to teach me to give the players more control over things. I would say before I started playing Star Wars and Dungeon World, I was the game master that kind of would have been very hesitant to go, what does that look like? And a good example of that is the first time they decided to go to a random diner on Coruscant that I wasn't planning on. I don't say I was annoyed at the table, but I was like, what are you guys trying to get at?
Right.
And my brain was trying to figure out what were they trying to do. And I was just like, I threw it back and I was like, so what does this diner look like? And their eyes lit up and they took off with describing it. I was like,
is this the home of Frelp?
Yes.
Yeah.
Like the pneumatic tubes and everything. And I said to myself, well, that was a great steal from Dungeon World with what does it look like, and force the players to kind of describe that, which now has become kind of almost a running gag. Anytime they decide they're going to go out to eat, I'm like, what does it look like? Where are you going? And letting them describe it. So yeah, I steal stuff from other games. I don't listen to a ton of other APs. Part of it is, yeah, I get to listen to a lot of podcasts, but I still, at work, I still have to problem solve.
Right.
So I can't always pay super attention. So sometimes I have to stop and wait a minute, what just happened, and back up. Like in your guys' show, wasn't too long ago, all of a sudden, you said the words, she's dead. And I was like, wait, what? Did Justin's character just die? Wait, did I miss something? Hold on. And I had to back it up. And I'm like, oh, okay. No, never mind.
I was like,
I thought I missed something for a second. And I got a little nervous. I was like, that could have been bad. But I was also kind of curious, if she did die, how would Justin react? But
yeah,
it didn't work out that way. That's just why I don't listen to a ton of APs.
Right, right.
That's why I like...
Sorry, I was just going to say, like, a lot of them, too, there are some that demand a lot of your attention, and there's some that don't, I feel like. But I'm also of the opinion of, like, if I'm going to listen to something, I want it to be something worth listening to. I don't know if that sounds snobbier than I meant it to, but, like, I want something that I can sink my teeth into, you know?
Absolutely. The other reason I don't listen to a ton of APs now, when we first started recording, I was listening to every Star Wars podcast I could listen to. All these different Star Wars podcasts, and I was like, I was so worried about not putting something in our storyline that was in one of their storylines that it became very stressful. And I just went, you know what, if we end up with something similar, oops, who cares? It was obviously a great idea, let's just go with it.
Right. And Star Wars is such a big universe, the chances of that happening really aren't super huge, you know, as long as you kind of point them in the right direction and blast them in one direction. Like, the only other Star Wars podcast I listen to is Campaign, and for example, they're very local in one sector of the galaxy, pretty much. They've only hopped planets a couple times, and they're all pretty much right next to one another. So I imagine in your case, like, you could just pretty much just set it anywhere else, and you don't have to worry about doubling up on those locations or worlds or themes or anything like that.
Yeah, probably. I just, like I said, I didn't want to have to worry about it anymore.
Right.
It was too much stress on me. What about you? Do you listen to any other shows or games and take ideas?
I listen to the Redemption Podcast. I like listening to other things for ideas mainly. Like you, like I'm kind of the opposite. I kind of like getting inspired by other shows and or other stories and taking a look at them and saying, if I had to reflavor this to fit into L5R, how would I do that? And while it's not an actual play show, it's still a story, so I'm going to cheat and use this as an example. The Spiritual Hunger episode with the cursed Gaki in the house where they find the katana, right?
Yep.
I straight up ripped that off from a Witcher quest, from a quest from The Witcher 3.
Oh.
Not ripped off, but reflavored and repurposed and put into Rokugan with the idea that there's this monster that used to be a person who is doing awful things in an attempt to break a curse that they don't quite understand, and the players have to do something else to break the curse. Otherwise, their fates are tied to this thing.
And I do something similar in a way. I take things out of stories and kind of reflavor them and put them in. I've taken stuff from some of the old Dragonlance books that I have read for years and put it into the game. Some different NPCs, personalities, and things like that. Just because I like introducing that for myself. It's kind of a nod to myself and my own childhood, so to speak, which makes me feel old to say.
I mean, like, I kind of do a similar thing where I think probably the closest modern phenomena to Legend of the Five Rings, I would say, is Game of Thrones. And I look to Game of Thrones all the time for inspiration. I mean, it's a bunch of warring houses who all hate each other, who are all pretty much part of the same culture, and them trying to backstab one another and get the upper hand. That's the plot of Game of Thrones, but that's sort of the background to our story, I would say.
Yeah, I would agree.
But I look into things like that of, for example, there's a war in my version of Rokugan between the lion and the unicorn clans. It's been a war that my players kind of kicked off unintentionally, but has been simmering in the background for a couple months in game time.
Okay.
And the idea that, you know, I was watching Game of Thrones, and this is a slight Game of Thrones spoiler, but at a certain point, I feel like people who want Game of Thrones have watched it by now. So
absolutely.
Okay. So Winterfell is not always in the hands of the Starks, House Stark. Eventually it gets taken over by their worst enemies. And there's a whole subplot of what it's like living in in your own home as a prisoner occupied. And so I introduce that as an element in this lion-unicorn war, saying, hey, the lion have captured the ancestral seat of the unicorn, and the unicorn lord, she is missing, and the lion are squatting on it. And not only are they owning it as a military capture, they're hosting their parties there. They're showing it off to other courtiers and other clans, saying, hey, look at this decadent splendor of what we've looted from this other clan. Look how good we are. So, like, little beats like that of basically, like, how can these different courtiers and big personalities in the world be assholes to one another? I steal from Game of Thrones all the time.
Nice. Only less nudity in your show.
Yeah, well, you know, season two, you never know.
Oh, fair enough.
No, I'm just kidding. There is nudity in our show. One of the early on, they all take a bath together.
Fair enough.
But nudity in Rokugan is also not a big deal. Like, I mean, you guys kind of play with that too, a little bit of Kirel constantly getting undressed in front of people.
Yeah, just because she doesn't think it's a big deal.
Right.
Part of that is because she, in her mind, is raised in the Jedi Temple, and that was just part of being a Jedi. They're not supposed to have attachments, so it's not a big deal.
And in Rokugan, the case is that, hey, you know what? Most samurai are soldiers. It's a co-ed integrated army. It's like Starship Troopers, you know? It's like, it's fine. Don't worry about it. No one looks at it that way.
And you guys have described geisha houses too. So it seems like that is not as big a deal.
Yeah. So geisha, if I'm going to push up my glasses here and talk about actually, geisha houses are really, in Rokugan, their entertainment, which is not always a adult entertainment. It's usually like samurai are these awful terrible people who do terrible things all day and have to bottle up all their emotions so they can go to a geisha and drink tea and listen to her play her Japanese guitar and open up to somebody. They're kind of like therapists almost.
Oh, gotcha. I guess maybe I was thinking the modern version of what a geisha is and not.
Right, and the shady geisha houses are definitely like that, but most upstanding geisha houses are there specifically. They're just talented artists and artisans who will be your accompaniment. It's kind of like a date for hire in a completely, and it's not intended to be a romantic or sexual way, but you know, humans are humans, so.
Yeah, oh, for sure. Yeah. Well, what are some of the things that keeps you podcasting?
That's a good question.
Because we all know
nothing.
We all know it's a big time commitment, and it is a lot of work. Now, yeah. I don't think it's hard work. Let me rephrase that. I don't think it's difficult work. It can be hard work, and it can be time consuming, but nothing mm-hmm. that's not impossible.
No, I think the number one thing is that if you are like you or I, where you know we weren't personalities. We weren't people in the RPG sphere before we started podcasting. We didn't come in with an audience necessarily, you know. We trucked away for a long time before you grew an audience. That's just sort of the way it works. And like the motivation for that first part is definitely just proving to yourself that you can do it, I think. And just the satisfaction of wanting to create something. But after that, once you start getting people who interact with you, I think my number one motivation is fan feedback, engagement, interactions, people asking me questions saying, wow, that was super cool. Why didn't this character do this instead? And like, oh, shit, this person is thinking about my show and they're thinking about the story I'm putting down. And like, just the most innocuous stuff like that, that's sort of what keeps me going and just interacting with my fans and the people who listen to the show and enjoy it.
I couldn't agree more. That's what keeps me going. And a lot of it for me too is just, it's really the relationships and the friends I built from doing it.
100%.
Meeting everybody in the RPG Academy was amazing. You know, going to a Catacon last year, and I was nervous. I'm like, all right, our show is starting to build up some steam. How's it going to work? And the very first game I go to run is a Star Wars game, and I sit down and I see somebody pull out dice. I'm like, oh, so you've played before? And he's like, no, I've just listened to a lot of it on podcasts. And I looked right at him and I'm like, great, which podcast do you listen to? And he just kind of looked up and pointed his finger at me. And I was like, I just made this awkward, didn't I?
I had the same thing at a Catacon when I sat down to play L5R. I played with Michael and Kendall. And then I played with two other people who I didn't recognize or I didn't know ahead of time. And I'm just like, oh, hey, so who here has like played L5R before? And one of the guys there raised his hand. I'm like, oh, okay, cool. Do you know how it works? Like, what editions did you play? And he's like, oh, yeah, I've listened to every episode of your show. And I'm like, oh, God, I got to live up to this now? Okay, well, you're about to hear me with no editing, so here's how it goes.
Which is funny because the gentleman I'm talking about is Richard, who actually has played, he plays Reese on the show with us, and he and I have become pretty good friends. And it was just one of those funny things where I was like, wow, I guess I should learn how to word things a little better when I sit down at a table and not make it awkward.
Yeah, so. You don't have the magic of editing. You don't have the magic of, hold on, let me take that again. Yeah, it's tough. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, that kind of stuff, I would just say to anybody listening, if you ever think that a creator is going to be bothered by what you're doing or your feedback or your positive things, that is just absolutely the fuel that they need to continue. Because let's be honest, we ain't in it for the money.
That's true.
I mean, we both have Patreons. They help cover the show, but a living they are not.
Correct.
And I think the number one motivation is just people, you know, saying nice things. Like there's times where I don't want to get too dark, but there's times where I'm like, I don't know if I want to keep doing the show. There's been moments like that. And
absolutely.
Yeah, and there's moments where you have to think of like, oh, I would be letting down these five people whose usernames I recognize now who comment on my episode every time it comes up and are saying, looking forward to the next one. Wow, can't believe that happened. I'm like, I owe those people an ending. And I don't know if this sounds sort of too navel-gazy or too Yeah, I don't know if that sounds too self-centered to say, but like, just like the fact of like motivating people who create things you like to do more of it is absolutely the best thing that you can do for them, I think.
Absolutely. I would agree 1,000%. And knowing that too is more interesting too. So when I finally do meet somebody that does a podcast that I like, knowing what reinforcement I like is so much easier for me to give them that reinforcement.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's neat to go up to them and go, oh my gosh, you're so-and-so from this show. Oh, I love this. I love that. Please keep doing it. You know, don't stop. And, you know, just engaging with them is really neat.
Right. And a place like a Catacon is just really an awesome place to do that because, as Ken Height said, you can't throw a brick in a Catacon and miss a podcaster. So,
absolutely.
Everybody's there. Yeah. Got a show. So,
or going to do a show or planning a show or wants to be on a show. Yeah.
Yeah.
I would 100% agree with that. Well, that's all I really had on my mind tonight. Do you have anything else on your mind?
Nope, that'll do it. I think we can both agree that we've said everything there is to say about playing role-playing games, and there's no need for any conversation after this one.
Awesome. Well, if you guys have any other questions or thoughts for myself or Tanner, give us a shout. Where can they find you on the internet?
You can listen to our podcast that I've been talking about so far called Shadow of the Cabal. We are on iTunes and Google Play and probably whatever other platform people have put us on. If you want to find us on Twitter, we're at twitter.com/SOTCpod. And if you like our show and you feel like kicking us a couple bucks to pay for hosting and pay for Dakota's new microphone that we just had to buy him, you can go to patreon.com/SOTCpod. And yeah, just talk to us on Twitter. That's where we're most active, and I'll probably talk back to you.
Awesome. And I will say Shadow of the Cabal is the number one L5R podcast out there. That's my opinion.
Number one, I will say number one L5R actual podcast in current production. I'll rest on that, Laura.
I'll say it's going to be the number one forever, and I'll stick by that. If you want to find us, obviously you downloaded our episode already. Otherwise, you can get a hold of me. My Twitter is Berlew_Chris. Otherwise, you can just hit at Redemption Pod. You can catch us on our Facebook feed. You can catch us on our website, Redemption Podcast. Otherwise, I think that's it. Thanks for listening to the bonus episode. Please reach out to myself or Tanner and ask us any other questions you have. And we'll see you in season 4.
This episode's Patreon backer is James. James, thank you so much for your support. It really means a lot to us.
Redemption Podcast is played using the Star Wars role-playing system by Fantasy Flight Games and Lucas Books. Please interact with us on social media, Facebook and Twitter, at Redemption Pod, Instagram, at Redemption Podcast. Visit our website, redemptionpodcast.com. Please leave us a review on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever other podcatcher you use. This will help people find us. And if you like us, please consider using Patreon. Our Patreon is patreon.com/redemption. Until next time.